Well, hello. Radio Solar System is back on the air again. So, welcome to Earth Science 2150. If you haven't looked at the presentation called Orientation and Related Podcast, that's probably the first thing you should do. This is part of the introductory module that we're dealing with now, but this particular presentation is more of an introduction to the course as a whole and some of the technical material that's in it. So you should now be looking at the title slide, which is called An Introduction to the Course, An Overview of Plans and Voyages, which is rather grandiose, but that's what we're going to do. Take a little bit of a tour through some of the places we'll be visiting over time. So as you already know, or should already know, there's a distinctive sound that will tell you to change the slide, and that sound is coming right now. So now we're at a slide that tells you what we're going to cover in this presentation. This is an introduction to the course. We're trying to give you some picture of the variety and the breadth of the topics that we'll deal with, and also introduce some of the concepts that we will use in this course too. Now, this is an Earth Science course. It doesn't have a whole lot of stuff related to the Earth, just one module of the course, but a lot of its principles come from Earth Science. Module 2 in this course, which is background science information, is intended to help you revise some of this science information and introduce some basic Earth science concepts that you'll need in order to do this course. So some of you are going to need to spend time looking at Module 2, which also has its own presentations associated with it. Some of you may not, but I do recommend that all of you at least take a look at this to try and understand some of the material that you will need to know in order to do well in this course. So let's move along to the next slide. This is slide 3. This is pretty much information that's already covered in the orientation class. There are 13 modules in this course. Most of them are split into two classes, each of which is about 50 minutes long. And that's what we did for in-person learning before we got into the online side of this course. There are also shorter little presentations in this course too that cover topical issues in planetary science. And what we do is ask students to give us some ideas about things that they'd like to discuss if they're interested in them, and we can bring these into the course. So every class that's in this course, including this one, consists of a PDF file that contains the visual material, and that goes with the podcast file, which is the one you're listening to now. So we're assuming that you can figure out how to put these things together. If you can't, go back and look at the orientation presentation, which will give you more information specifically. Okay. The in-person classes that are given in this course are summaries of key points and topics for each module. They don't have all of the details that are in the classes that are placed online because there isn't enough time within one slot to do it. So you need to look at the online material as well as the in-person or the overview classes. Both of those things are important. So let's move along to the next slide. Slide 4. Okay, well, that's a picture of the galaxy. Well, actually, it's not really our galaxy because we don't have any pictures of our galaxy, really, because we're in it. This is a picture of the Andromeda Spiral Galaxy, which is the nearest galaxy to ours and is probably considered to be an analogue of the galaxy that we're in. So the Earth is located on one of the spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy, and the Sun is one of about 300 billion stars that probably exist within the Milky Way galaxy. How many galaxies are there in the universe? Well, we really don't know that with complete confidence because we can only see so far. But you can be sure that it's well beyond what we can conceive of. So we are a very tiny part of something that is incredibly vast. And we're just going to learn something about this in this course. Next slide, please. Okay, if you're interested in Earth Science, and this is primarily an Earth Science course, you should consider a course called Earth Science 1000. It's called Earth Systems. It's a very good course, and it does include some basic planetary science material, very essential stuff. So if you've done this course, that's going to be a big advantage with this one, because this course will include some material that's already been touched on in there and will include some of the concepts that come from that. If you've not done it, and perhaps you are interested in earth science, give it some serious consideration, because it's a very interesting course that once again will change your views on a lot of things if you do it. Next slide. Next slide is slide 6. Now, maybe you're interested in astronomy. Maybe you're more interested in stars and galaxies. And if that's the case, well, think about Physics 2151, Stellar Astronomy and Astrophysics. This does actually have a bit of overlap with my own course. To a small extent, some of the concepts are shared, but this course goes much further than we do. It talks about stellar evolution, the evolution of stars and galaxies. It talks about things like dark matter, black holes, and all sorts of wonderful things that are well on the edge of our imagination. There's no doubt about that. The course textbook for this course has a lot of material in it that's relevant to 2151. And you've got it for a year, so it is something to consider if you have an interest in that aspect of it. We can't possibly do all of it. Now to the next slide. Slide 7. This is information on the course textbook. This was mentioned in the orientation too. This was a new textbook in 2021. I was impressed with it then, and I'm still impressed with it. It's a very good book, very well written. You can find an earlier edition of this book from 2010 on the PDF as an internet, and I will provide some information on that later on. I don't think that you necessarily have to have this textbook to pass the course. Lots of people do so without having the textbook, but I think to get really good marks and to really get a good understanding, a good textbook is very helpful, because we cannot discuss everything, and this is a good textbook. It's one of the best textbooks I've seen in terms of its writing. So seriously, give that some consideration, and I will give some information on other places where you can find information as we go through the course as well. So now to the next slide, which is slide 8. So let's have a course overview. Well, we start out with the Big Bang, and we close out with the end of the world. In a nutshell, that's what we do. Okay, now the Big Bang didn't really look like it's shown here, because at the time of the Big Bang, there weren't any stars or galaxies. In fact, there was no light within the universe at all. So, nevertheless, we cover a lot of time. The Big Bang happened about 13.9 billion years ago. Our own solar system is about 4.5 billion years old. But why are Earth scientists interested in understanding the solar system? That's one of the questions that we might ask here. Why would we be interested in understanding Mars or Venus or the moons of Jupiter? Well, there are a number of good reasons, and I'll just highlight a couple of them in our course introduction for you to think about. Next slide. Slide 9. Well, some things out there can have an impact on us, quite literally. Okay? Asteroids, for example, have impacted the Earth quite frequently over time, and my old friend Jerry Squires is going to give a lecture on impacts in Earth history as part of this course. So about 65 million years ago, a large asteroid or comet collided with the Earth and contributed to a major mass extinction, which brought the reign of the dinosaurs to an end. Now, there are other benefits to this. You might think that they're all bad, but not necessarily. You might have heard of the nickel deposits in Sudbury, Ontario. Second largest concentration of nickel deposits in the world, of great interest today. They're related also to an impact event involving an asteroid, but one that happened much, much earlier in Earth history. So things that are happening out in the solar system definitely have influence on the Earth. There's no question about that. Let's have a look at the next slide now. Slide 10. Some of you might have heard of this gentleman, if you did Earth Science 1000 perhaps. His name, Milutin Milankovic, is synonymous with an idea that there are orbital and rotational variations related to the Earth that are really astrophysical things that affect the climate. So the theory says that as the Earth goes around and orbits around the Sun, our orbit changes slightly and some of our rotational parameters change, and that affects how much solar energy reaches the Earth. Now, obviously, that affects our climate. Now, please don't go away thinking that this is the responsible agent for things like climate change, because we are now having a huge impact on the climate through our own activities. So, Milankovitch's ideas do not connect to modern climate warming, but they do provide, if you like, the background information on the Earth's climate, and they have been proven to be quite correct Earth's climate varies on a long-term basis as a result of these effects. Let's have a look at the next slide now for another reason. So now we go to slide 11. Now you all know what that is. That's a picture of the moon. Now if you've looked at the moon, you'll know that the moon has dark areas and it has light areas on it. They are geologically different. That shouldn't really be a great surprise. The highlands are very, very ancient. They're greater than 4.2 billion years old for the most part. The dark areas are much younger. They formed about 3.5 billion years ago, and they were formed by intense bombardment by asteroids in the early history of the solar system. Now, those same asteroids must have bombarded the Earth as well, but we have no records on the Earth of any consequence that relate to this very early time period, because the Earth is an active planet, so therefore it eradicates some of its own geological history over time. So we find very few samples of rocks or even minerals of these ages. So that means that we can learn about the early history of the Earth by looking at other objects in the solar system. Other bodies in the solar system give us information that we can never find on the Earth. In the same way, we can look at the Earth, at processes that happen on the Earth, and apply those elsewhere in the solar system. Next slide. This is slide 12. Well, a couple of books here. One of these is a fictional book. Some of you might have read it. Kim Stanley Robinson, a well-known science fiction writer. The other one is a factual book. It's about a book that makes the case for exploring and colonizing Mars in the future. So these are recurrent themes in science fiction. Of course, people are always running around on other planets. It hasn't happened yet, aside from brief visits to the moon in the late 60s and the early 1970s, but one day it will be a reality, I hope, not just maybe a reality. So we need to find out things about other worlds. If we're ever going to go to Mars, well, we need to know an awful lot about Mars before we even set foot on it. So that's very important. That's a good reason for exploring parts of the solar system too, quite apart from our natural human inclination to explore. And so to the next slide. Slide 13, it's a picture I like to use. It's two sets of footprints, one set of footprints that are 3 million years old in Africa, made by very distant ancestors of human beings. Another one made by Neil Armstrong on the moon in 1969. Now that period of about 3 million years is incredibly brief compared to the history of the Earth and the history of the solar system. And yet we have progressed over that time from walking in a dried up lake bed and leaving footprints to walking on another planet, or a planet-sized object. It's actually a moon, of course, within the solar system. So that's a huge step that's been made in that respect. So we can expect future endeavours to be equally rapid in their development, if you like. So I hope that, you know, within time and within your lifetimes, most of your lifetimes, that you will see humans on Mars and perhaps in other places in the solar system as well. Next slide, please. Well, most of you have heard of Star Trek, even though you didn't probably see the original TV episodes that I saw when I was a kid. But most of the modern technology we have today was actually predicted in Star Trek, as people have often pointed out. Now, of course, this was largely because they had to cut corners with their studio budgets, but it is quite interesting in a way, because most of these things now exist, and it's the space program research that eventually provided the tools to much of modern technology. So even though space exploration is expensive, and space exploration may not visibly yield immediate results for humankind, it certainly does yield technology. The technology that came from the space programs is the stuff that we see all around us and which we depend on today. Okay, so there's a final reason why we should be interested in learning more about the solar system, because that process of learning also provides us with new tools that we can apply to other things as well. Next slide. Okay, slide 15. This is a famous photograph. This is NASA's Blue Marble image. It isn't a real photograph. It's actually a composite of a number of photographs, but it's a very striking photograph. Now, one of the benefits of the space program when it happened and the exploration to the moon was that for the first time, we saw the Earth as a complete entity floating in space, an island of life in the void, if you like. And one thing that you all know is that the Earth is a unique place. Even if you don't know much about the solar system, you know that there's nowhere else like it in the solar system. You've probably heard that saying, there's no planet B. Well, it's true, there's no planet B. Why is the Earth as it is? Is it because we just happen to be lucky enough to have a planet that's just fitted out for living things? Or are there more complex things involved here? In particular, is the presence of life on the Earth one of the most important factors in why the Earth is like it is today? Is the Earth a planet that has been transformed by the presence of life? Now, many years ago, few people thought this. In today's world, many people believe this to be the case, is that much of the evolution of Earth is connected to the evolution of life on Earth. Life has had a huge impact on our planet. And of course, we're interested to find out about the possibilities for life elsewhere in the universe. And we will get to that in this course as well. To the next slide now. So we'll come back to Earth with this slide 16. This is a map of the Earth. It's not a familiar map for many of you. It's a map of the tectonic plates of the Earth. We live on a planet that's dynamic. The surface or the outer portion of the Earth is in constant but very slow motion, as a function really of internal heat and heat loss. And that's what gives us a lot of geological processes. That's really at the root of all this. Earthquakes, volcanic activity, a whole load of other stuff too. So one of the obvious questions that we'd like to ask is whether we see evidence of such processes elsewhere in the solar system as well. And we will look at this in quite some detail. Next slide. You may be familiar with something called the Earth system hypothesis. This is slide 17. Earth systems holds that the Earth, all the portions of the Earth, all the things we're familiar with, are closely connected. In other words, something that happens in one sector of the Earth, be it the atmosphere or the hydrosphere or the biosphere, will affect all of the others too. This is a modern concept that now underlies a lot of Earth science. You may also have heard something called the Gaia hypothesis, an idea that was developed in large part by a visionary scientist called James Lovelock, who died just a couple of years ago at the age of 101, I believe. So, essentially, this suggests that life doesn't just happen to exist on the Earth. It suggests that life has had a major impact on the development of the Earth and the processes that we see on the Earth. So in addition to being a dynamic planet, Earth is also a living planet. And that is a very important feature of the Earth that we'll emphasize in this course as well. So now to the next slide. Slide 18. Here's a couple of pictures of another planet. One of them is a picture of Mars as it is today, a cold and dry planet that has ice caps and a rather inhospitable environment. The other one is a picture of what some people call the warm and wet early Mars. So the idea here is that if the Earth is a planetary system that's changed over time, that the same probably applies to other planets in the solar system too, that they've also changed over time as well. And we do know that Mars was once a wet world. It once had running water on its surface. We don't know the extent of that water, and we still don't know about its early climate, but it might have been a lot warmer and had a much thicker atmosphere with a lot more carbon dioxide to keep it warm. So Mars is probably a world that has altered over time as well, but in a different direction to that of the Earth. Okay? So understanding these changes is important. It's important in understanding this from the perspective of understanding the Earth, and also in terms of understanding the potential for life on other planets too. And one thing we have shown in the last 150 to 200 years is that you can alter the entire environment of a planet. And we've done that by putting extra carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. And we're living with the consequences of that now and trying to find a way around it. So clearly, planetary environments are not things that persist indefinitely without change. Next slide, please. Now, here's a picture of a planet that's much more like the Earth in terms of size. This is Venus. Now, that's a radar image that you see on the left because we can't see the surface of Venus. Mostly what we see are its cloud layers. It has thick clouds there. Well, Venus is certainly not like the Earth. Temperatures on Venus are high enough to melt metals and destroy spacecraft. Its atmosphere would crush you just as easily as the ocean would crush you on the Earth. It rains sulfuric acid, if it rains at all. But some people suggest that there might be life persisting in the clouds of Venus, too. A few years ago, discovery of phosphine gas led to this suggestion. So Venus is a terrible place, even though size-wise it's very similar to the Earth. Why is this? How did it end up like this? And what happened on Venus to turn it into such a dreadful place compared to the Earth? So we'll try and answer that question as well, as far as we can answer that question. Next slide. So, to Mars. Now, some things in the solar system are pretty familiar. Well, one example of this is volcanic activity. The volcanoes on Mars are really very similar to those that we see on the Earth, except that they're much larger. We also have very similar volcanic structures to this on Venus, too. So some things seem to be common within the solar system. We can recognize them in other places. The most common rock type on terrestrial planets is a rather ordinary black volcanic rock called basalt. That's also the most common rock type on the Earth, too. But some things that we're going to encounter in this course are completely alien in their appearance and to a large extent unknown in origin, too. Okay? That particularly applies when we get to the outer solar system. But once again, remember that the Earth has evolved over time. So it's very likely that other planets and objects in the solar system have also evolved over 4.5 billion years, too. We need to find those common threads in order to understand those processes. This is an image of the largest volcano on Mars, called Olympus Mons, Mount Olympus, appropriately, which is also the largest volcano in the entire solar system. Not the most active volcano in the solar system, but certainly the largest. And we'll get there eventually in part two of the course. Next slide, please. So where have we been in terms of exploring the solar system and where are we going? Well, we've been exploring the solar system for about 65 years now, okay? A little bit more than that, perhaps, okay? Pioneer 6 was the first interplanetary probe, and it's still out there somewhere, although we haven't heard from it in quite a long time. In the late 60s, we landed on the moon, what we call the Apollo era, and that's the only place we've actually visited in person. In the late 70s, a remarkable series of missions called the Voyager missions were launched, and this really gave us our first glimpse into the outer solar system. And I call them mind-blowing excursions. They were. They really introduced a lot of things that we'd never really considered at all in the outer solar system. And they remain one of the most important sources of information for parts of the outer solar system too, particularly for the planets Uranus and Neptune. We really don't have other information. We then got into a lot of robot exploration of planets, particularly Mars, but also places like Mercury, Jupiter and Saturn too, and also attempts to get out to asteroids and comets and other things. Mars has probably seen the greatest amount of surface exploration, and that's sensible because it really is the most Earth-like of all the other planets. Back in 2015, almost 10 years ago now, a mission called New Horizons was launched from the Earth and eventually flew past Pluto and out into the outer solar system. It's now out in what we call the Kuiper Belt. So that's the furthest one we've gone. And there are also new missions that have been launched since I've been teaching this course. The Parker Solar Probe was launched in 2018 to explore the Sun, and we'll check in with this particular mission as we go. And there are other ongoing missions to Jupiter, to asteroids, and also to Mercury as well. So planetary exploration is very active, and there are many plans for new missions as well. So lots and lots of things are happening in planetary science. To the next slide. This is slide 22. As I detailed in the orientation to this course, basically, there are two parts to this course. Part one deals with background concepts in science and methods and things that relate to the overall patterns and picture of the solar system. We also talk a bit about exoplanets and the wider universe in that part too. Part two of the course is a tour through planets and other important places in the solar system. And we finally end up discussing life on Earth and life possibilities elsewhere too. So you're currently in Module 1 right now, which is the introduction. Module 2, which you'll find there on Brightspace, gives you an introduction into key science concepts. That's not covered in an in-person class, and not all of you will need to look at that, but some of you will definitely need to look at it. So without ado, let's go on and let's just take a little tour through some of the material that's in this course and just give you a few snapshots of some of the things we will get around to discussing in time. Next slide, slide 23. Well, first of all, there's nothing new about looking at the stars. Human beings have been looking at the stars ever since we've been around. That's for sure. And we have lots of ancient monuments that relate to stargazing, like Stonehenge. We'll talk about this. Why are we interested in the stars? Well, number of reasons. A very practical reason for being interested in the stars and in stellar observations and observations of astronomy is timekeeping, because we needed calendars. Calendars were things that determined agriculture for early societies. And we were also pretty superstitious. Most of our gods and goddesses that we've defined and forces that we've envisaged beyond our own world have lived in the skies, basically. So things like eclipses, they were pretty scary for people in the old days. But they were also very important events as well, because they also helped in the development of calendars, because they were predictable in various respects. So we've been looking at the planets and the stars for a very long time, but only really in the last 500 years or so have we really been looking at them from a purely scientific perspective, although the ancient Greeks did quite a lot of work that contributed to our modern knowledge. Next slide. Now, you've all heard of this. You've all heard of these constellations. These are some of the signs of the zodiac: Aries, Taurus, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, and some others too. What are the signs of the zodiac? And why are there 12 of them? Well, the 12 has something to do with the months of the year, as you might imagine from what you read in the newspapers. But what's the ecliptic? What is the ecliptic plane and why is it important? This is one of the things that we'll talk about. These are origins of astronomical science and origins of planetary science are rooted really in early ideas of astrology. Next slide. This is slide 25. It's a picture of hundreds of thousands of stars. So we're going to stay mostly in the solar system, but we are going to talk about stellar evolution a little bit too, because it is important. And you can see right away from this photograph that some of the stars are brighter than others and some of them seem bigger than others and they have different colours. Why is that? Why are stars different colours? Why are some brighter than others? Is there sense among stellar populations? If we were to analyse a human population, we could describe it by various statistical measures. Well, we can do that with stars as well. So we'll talk a bit about that and what that means. Next slide, please. Slide 26. We're going to meet quite a few historical figures at one time or another. Some of them will be familiar to you. I hope that Isaac Newton is familiar for sure. Aristarchus of Samos was long before Newton, but also well ahead of his times, one of the first people to suggest that the Earth actually orbited around the Sun rather than vice versa. So we'll talk about the evolution of modern ideas about the solar system and about astronomical motions and planetary motions, because these are very important. It's also a good illustration of how science progresses and sometimes doesn't progress. Next slide, please. We'll also talk about things like gravity and also a little bit about Einstein's ideas about the universe too. Now, nobody likes mathematical formulas, and mathematical formulas are not something that I emphasize in this course, but I do expect people to understand the concepts behind these things. For example, the idea that gravity is related to the masses of objects and the distance between them, which is not really so complicated, except that Albert Einstein provided an alternative explanation. But most of the time, what Isaac Newton suggested in the 17th century is still absolutely correct with respect to gravity. So that's where a lot of our ideas about planetary motions actually come from still. So we'll learn about that in a little bit more detail than I show you in this slide. Next slide, please. Slide 28. Well, we'll also talk about energy in the solar system and the universe too. And that's important for a number of respects, but to a large extent it's important because by analysing the energy that comes from objects, whether it's direct energy coming from stars or the sun, or reflected energy that's coming from the earth, or that's just radiated by the earth or other objects, these are ways in which we find out about distant objects without ever having to go there. By using these methods, we can find out things about the surface of Mars. We can find out things about the motion of stars. And we can even detect the presence of planets around other stars by using these methods. So the electromagnetic spectrum and understanding electromagnetic energy, as well as understanding kinetic energy, is important in this course. We will spend some time talking about this in part one of the course. Next slide. Next slide, slide 29, that's a solar flare. Now that's a threat to the Earth, one which we've managed to escape serious impacts from over time for the most part. We're going to talk about the Sun in this course because the Sun is more than 99% of the total mass in the solar system and is obviously its most important object. The Sun is not always a benevolent source of light and heat. It is potentially hazardous, particularly to our modern society. We'll talk about how long the Sun might exist, and also about the evidence for other suns having planets as well. So things that happen there are directly of importance to what we see on the Earth. We'll talk about models for solar system formation and evolution. This is slide 30. This is a picture from a very long way away that probably shows a planetary system forming around a young star. These gaps in this disk that we see are probably where planets are starting to collect. Are planetary systems routine things in the universe and the galaxy, or are they highly anomalous? Is our solar system unique in some way? Nowadays, we know the answer to this. We know that planets are everywhere in the galaxy and probably in the universe too. The idea of the solar system being unique has definitely been dispersed, but that doesn't mean that our solar system is typical of every solar system that exists, and we'll find out more about that as we go too. Next slide. Well, we're going to spend some time talking about asteroids and meteorites for a couple of reasons. One of them is that they're of much interest to us in terms of being a possible threat to the Earth, but also because they give us vital information about the early history of the solar system. This is kind of like the mess that's left around after a building project. You know, it'll tell you how things were put together. And asteroids and comets, particularly, tell us a lot about the development of the solar system, but there's still a lot of things we don't understand. We don't understand a lot of things about comets in particular, which are especially important because they're likely the sources of some of the organic molecules that eventually might have led to the first formation of living organisms. Next slide, please. And speaking of comets, of course, they're always interesting because they're so spectacular. They are probably some of the most visually striking things that we ever see outside of our planet. And like eclipses, comets were regarded as very bad omens. They were worse than eclipses because at least you could reasonably predict an eclipse based on historical observations, but you couldn't predict comets very easily at all. In fact, some of them are predictable, but only on timescales that are much longer than human lives. Comets come from the outer limits of the solar system, and they're still very mysterious in many, many ways. There are lots of things that we still have to find out about comets. Next slide. Well, when we get to part two of the course, we start out on the Earth. I always like this particular quote by Arthur C. Clarke, who was a science fiction writer, who said that it's strange that we should call it Earth when so clearly it is sea. Well, obviously the Earth is not really an Earth planet. It's a water planet. Almost 70% of the Earth is covered by oceans. Okay, if we were to drain all those oceans away, we can see that we have quite a remarkable elevation pattern on the Earth. We have low-lying areas and high-standing areas that form dry lands and continents. So there's got to be a good reason for that, because we certainly don't see that on all other planets. So this is where we'll start out with our study of the Earth, by trying to understand some of these features and why the Earth is unique. And when we get finished with the Earth, we'll move along to other places and try and apply some of this knowledge. Next slide. Slide 34. As I mentioned before, the Earth has not always been as we see it now. 4.5 billion years ago, it was a pretty horrible place. It had an ocean of magma on it. It was being bashed by large meteorites. Its atmosphere was poisonous. It was spinning much faster and had lots of nasty radiation around too. So that was a pretty hostile place. But somehow, life began on this planet, probably more than 4 billion years ago. Now today, we have a remarkable world that has a temperate climate despite our efforts to change it. It has an oxygenated atmosphere. It's got a 24-hour day. It's pretty safe from most radiation aside from UV, which still causes problems. But most of all, what's different about it is that it's living. It's full of life at every scale. And it's a world that probably has been transformed over time, largely through the activities of life, and also geological processes, of course, but those geological processes in turn depend on life. So the important thing, of course, is that the Earth is alive and life is part of the Earth system, and humanity is part of the Earth system as well. So let's just take a look at the next slide. So how are we going to talk about the Earth in just two classes in this course? Well, it's not easy, I can tell you that. Okay, there's a huge amount of stuff to cover. If you've done an Earth science course, this will really help you. But you do need to look at Module 2 if you've never done any Earth science, because this will give you a bit of background, some concepts and things like that will help you understand what we're talking about there. Okay, and basically what we do in treating the Earth is we break it into two parts. We first of all talk about the solid Earth, you know, things like internal structure, continents, plate tectonics, all that sort of stuff. And then we talk about the surface environment of the Earth, in which the emphasis is more on the atmosphere and also the water on the Earth too. Water is particularly important from a planetology viewpoint because water is considered, in our view at least, to be the key to life. Where we're going to find life, if we ever find it elsewhere in the solar system, it will likely be in association with water. But, as I said before, all of these things are connected. Okay, so now we're done with the Earth. Where else are we going to go after that? Next slide. Slide 36. Well, we head off first to the Moon. Now, the Moon isn't really a planet, but it is planet size. You know, the Earth-Moon system is actually unique within the solar system in terms of the very large size of the satellite compared to the parent body that it orbits. The Moon was pretty important to the Earth, too. It helps keep the Earth's orbit stable, its rotation stable, but it was probably formed by a catastrophic event in the early history of the solar system, so we'll learn about that. Now, Mercury looks an awful lot like the Moon, and it is similar in many respects, but it's different in other respects, too. It's different internally, for sure, and probably some of its surface rock types are different as well. But they're both examples of what we might call small terrestrial planets. They're small, airless worlds, lots of hazardous radiation, no atmosphere, bombarded by asteroids and meteorites and tiny things of all sizes at all times. So they're probably not very friendly places. But the Moon itself will probably be of enormous strategic value to humankind in the long run as a staging point to other places. So let's have a look at the next slide now. We move along from the Moon, we go to Venus. Well, Venus is probably a worse place to go to than the Moon. Okay, here's a couple of images by a digital artist whose work I like. His name is Walter Myers, and he has a very good website. And he's got some pictures, like the one on the right, that visualize the surface of Venus. Now, probably doesn't really look like this because compared to the Earth, Venus is actually a pretty flat place. It doesn't have the same kind of magnitude of topographic variations that the Earth would have if we drained the oceans. An actual photograph of the surface of Venus that comes from a Soviet lander is shown in the larger picture in this slide. And you can see that doesn't look very inviting, that's for sure. Venus is a pretty awful place. The conditions on the surface of Venus are just terrible, okay? And a very, very hard place to explore. So we'll probably never know a great deal about the surface of Venus, but we do know some things about it. We know it's active volcanically. Just recently, just this year, an analysis of information from radar imaging showed us changes that were related to volcanic eruptions. But Venus, I guess, was a bit of a disappointment, really, to planetary scientists when the truth became apparent about how awful a place it was. Next slide, please. To science fiction writers and in literature, Venus had a different image for a long period of time. C.S. Lewis, who's a famous writer, best known for The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, of course, he envisaged it as a tropical world with islands of floating vegetation on a vast ocean. And Lewis was probably inspired by the Garden of Eden because his books contain a lot of Christian mythology. But Venus is nothing like this. It's totally different, that's for sure. And it's doubtful it's anything like the Garden of Eden. It's more like the depths of hell, perhaps, in terms of biblical analogues. Next slide, please. From Venus, we go to Mars. Now, as a famous pop song said, it's not the kind of place to raise your kids, but Mars is probably the best bit of territory we have at our disposal in the solar system, because its scenery really is very Earth-like. We see a lot of pictures of Mars. Sure, it's a barren desert, doesn't look very hospitable, but it looks like a lot of regions on the Earth too. And we know that Mars once had running water at least, and may even have had oceans of some kind as well. And we do know that ancient sedimentary rocks occur on Mars. Now, sedimentary rocks are very common on the Earth. They're the source of our geological record. But Mars is probably the only place in the solar system where they actually exist right now that we know of. Okay? It's the best bet we have. So we have a lot of eggs in the Mars basket. We're exploring it in great detail and looking particularly for signs that life might once have existed here in its early days. It certainly is a harsh environment now, but probably not as harsh in its early history. So, much more to be discovered there. Next slide, please. So to slide 40. These are some other examples of Martian landscapes. That's Victoria Crater. There was a picture of that in the orientation module as well. See the sand dunes on the bottom of it. See the sand dunes in these other pictures too. So Mars is a place that actually has active surface processes. They're mostly driven by wind now, but at one time water was active on Mars as well. So it is of prime interest in understanding the possible presence of life on other worlds. So to the next slide now. This is slide 41. This is a postcard that somebody sent me from Mars. Well, not really, okay? Mars has an amazing feature on it that's often called the Martian Grand Canyon. It's called the Valles Marineris. It's named after the Mariner spacecraft. Well, it's not really like the Grand Canyon, at least we don't think so. We think it's probably more like the Great Rift Valley of East Africa, for example. But water did help to carve this feature. And some people believe that there might have been oceans on Mars at one time. So there are quite astonishing topographic features on Mars, including the largest volcanoes in the solar system as well. So one day, Mars might well be a place that people go on adventure tourism trips to, although it's likely to be a few centuries yet. Okay, so when we leave Mars, we have a rather long trip from Mars, because we have to make it out to the outer solar system through the asteroid belt, and that's quite a long trip. And when we get to the outer solar system, it's a very different world, I can assure you. Next slide, please. Slide 42. Well, first of all, everything in the outer solar system is huge by comparison to the inner solar system, as you can see from these size comparisons. On the scale of the universe, it's likely that gas giants and ice giant planets are far more common than the terrestrial planets that we know and love. We don't know that for sure, because it's very hard for us to detect terrestrial planets, but we can certainly find gas giant planets. I guess the question we have is, are the gas giants in our solar system typical of what we see all around the galaxy or not? Or are they unique in some respects? They're all different, even though they have common themes. I think that's the main thing that I would say at this point. To the next slide, please. Slide 43. Here's a couple of pictures from Jupiter. This is from an active mission, the Juno mission, which is named for Jupiter's wife in Greek mythology. Juno is making images of the entirety of Jupiter's surface. Well, not really a surface, because it doesn't have a surface. They're actually images of its outer atmosphere, really. There's no solid surface on Jupiter at all, or on the other gas giants. It's also measuring things like magnetic fields, radiation, and all sorts of other things. And it's creating absolutely stunning visual imagery. Here you see the Great Red Spot. Now that's a storm system on Jupiter. It's a bit like an anticyclone would be on the Earth, but it's been around for at least 400 years and probably a lot longer than that. And it's just one of many long-lived storm systems on the planet. It's much larger than the Earth. You could fit the Earth into it several times. And the other picture shows you bands and zones in Jupiter's atmosphere. It has these brown areas and these white areas, which are atmospheric circulation zones. They, in fact, have some similarities to atmospheric circulation patterns that we see on the Earth. Now, Jupiter in particular has an amazing collection of moons, okay? Some of which are like planets in their own right. The other outer planets also contain interesting moons as well, and we will discuss these as we get to them. Next slide. That's slide 44. This is Saturn. Saturn is easily the most beautiful planet in the solar system, if you want my own opinion. It's not as visually striking in natural light as Jupiter because it's kind of hazy, but this is an example of what's called false color imaging. And to bring out banding on Saturn related to different temperatures within its atmosphere in this particular case. And once again, you can see some of these storm systems on Saturn. Storm systems that are not quite as large as those of Jupiter, but probably just as long-lived. We've only really been able to look at them in the last 50 years or so. Okay? The winds on Saturn are even stronger than the winds on Jupiter, and they're pretty strong on Jupiter too. So Saturn and Jupiter are different in some ways, even though they're similar in many respects as well. And we'll often find this as a theme as we go through the solar system. Trying to understand these differences is one of the most important things. Now, one of the things that you might think is different about Saturn is the presence of the rings, because these are a remarkable feature of Saturn. But in fact, all of the outer planets have rings. It's just that they're not so easily visible for Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune. Okay, let's have a look at the next slide now. And that's slide 45, which is Uranus and Neptune, which are more or less the same size, actually. Slightly different hazy shades of blue, gorgeous blue shades, in fact. That's related to the presence of methane, which is a simple organic molecule that's present on these planets. Okay? Our information about this region is pretty scanty. Most of it comes from the Voyager missions. Obviously, there are some similarities to Jupiter and Saturn. That big blue thing that we see on Neptune is probably a large storm system, although we don't know as much about it as we do about storm systems on Jupiter. They have many satellites as well, but only one large moon out here. And that's a moon called Triton, which orbits Neptune. And Triton is a very weird place. When we get there, you'll find out that it's quite unique in the solar system in a lot of respects. So that's it for the eight planets. Now, when I was a kid, there was a ninth planet called Pluto, but Pluto's now been demoted. It's now called a dwarf planet. We will get into the reasons for its demotion and what exactly a dwarf planet is, but not at this point. So let's go to the next slide now. We're not quite finished with the solar system yet. So moving along to slide 46 now, the New Horizons mission is currently our most distant planetary observer. It's out in a region beyond Pluto called the Kuiper Belt, okay? And the Kuiper Belt contains a large number of presumably icy objects. It's probably a source for many of the comets. And the last place it went to is a place called Arrokoth, okay? It went to Arrokoth in 2019, okay? Arrokoth is a bitty strange object. It's about 70 kilometers, I believe, in size, and it looks like a child's toy, a bit like a rubber duck, almost. Okay? And the data from this particular encounter are now all present on the Earth, but it took 2 years to get the information back to the Earth. Communication with spacecrafts in the outer solar system is not like broadband internet. It's very slow. It's like old dial-up modems, basically. So it takes a very long time for that information to come back, and it'll take a long time to digest it, too. But people are now starting to work with the data from this most distant object and understand what it might actually mean. And we will get out there at the very end of the course and visit Arrokoth and maybe a few other places out there too. We don't know much about this stuff at all, but it is very much at the outer frontier of what we're trying to learn about in planetary science. Next slide. And finally, the biggest question of all in planetary science. life? Well, maybe it's not the biggest question, but it's one of the biggest questions. Now, we know there's life on the Earth, and we can document its evolution on the Earth. We have a fossil record. That fossil record is not complete, but it is quite remarkable in a lot of respects. We now understand that the evolution of life has probably influenced the history of planet Earth to a large extent. So the other question we need to ask then is, where would we look for life elsewhere in the solar system? Would we look for it on Mars, perhaps? Would we look for it on the moons of Jupiter, also suggested? Or might there be life out around other stars? You know, is it possible that other solar systems that exist within the galaxy and the universe have intelligent life forms that are looking for us, just as we are looking for them? So we'll talk about that at the very end of the course. It's a great place to finish. And a great place to finish up this particular introductory presentation as well. So on that topic, if you've ever seen the original Star Wars movie, and it's worth seeing, even if the special effects are kind of cheesy, it's a classic in its genre, there's no doubt about that. But there's a famous scene where a bunch of species of various kinds are drinking in a sleazy bar on a distant planet in the galaxy. And well, ask this question, you know, could this actually happen? First of all, are there living intelligent beings elsewhere in the stars? But more importantly, if there are, what are the chances that two or more intelligent species might coexist in time? Don't forget that the universe is over 13 billion years old. And last but not least, it seems pretty unlikely that alien species would enjoy having a beer or a glass of wine like humans do. But we'll talk about some of these probabilities at the very end of the course, and we'll discuss something you may have heard of called the Drake equation. The Drake equation is a theoretical formulation of the prospects for life in the galaxy and what it implies for the realistic prospects of life as we know it, or maybe as we don't know it, to quote Star Trek. Okay, so that is it for the introduction to Earth Science 2150. There's just one more slide left. And that's a picture of a modern rocket. That's Jeff Bezos' Amazon rocket, which looks like he bought it from a mail order catalogue. We've got a long way to go, and we have a great deal to learn in this course. Unfortunately, we can't take a ride on that rocket, and I'm still not sure I'd actually want to. But anyway, before we go on our voyage, we're going to need background science concepts. I think I might have mentioned this before, at least two or three times, and I'm going to mention it again now. If you think your basic science is rusty, or you've never done any Earth Science courses, you need to look at Module 2 of this course. You'll find information in there that gives you some revision on this material and some introduction to basic concepts, and it is important for you to look at it. That's really your first task, what you might call pre-departure training for some people in this course. So if you've got time now that term has just started, have a look at Module 2, and hopefully you remember most of it. And if you don't remember it, you can learn the rest. And finally, what else do I have to say? Not very much. One final slide. I mentioned before about space news items. There's always news about planetary science research out there. There's always news information out there. Keep looking for it, because I would like to hear about this. I'd like you to make suggestions for things that we might like to discuss in class as we go through the course. Obviously, I have some things in mind. Some things come from previous iterations of the course as well, because we're following particular things. But I would like to hear about these. It's a way to contribute to the course as you learn from it. And I think that will improve your overall experience and make it more interesting. So I'm not going to detain you any further here at Radio Solar System, because you've got quite a lot of stuff to do right now. Okay, have a look at the overview of Module 2. There is a short overview, and that will give you some idea of the stuff that's covered in it, and that might help you decide how much of it you need to look at in detail. But for the moment, I'll wish you all good day, good morning, or good night, whatever time it is where you are, and we'll be back together again before too long. Thank you very much.